This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
1-800-Flowers.com is more than your birthday, anniversary, or just because gift-giving destination. We put our hearts into everything we do to help you celebrate all life's special occasions with friends and family. From our farmers and bakers, florists and makers, everything from 1-800-Flowers is made with love every step of the way, because we know that nothing is more important than delivering a smile. To learn more, visit 1-800-Flowers.com/ACAST. That's 1-800-Flowers.com/ACAST.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Alan Kerbishley, former professional player and professional manager.
Alan, I wonder, when you're standing on the touchline managing a visiting team at Old Trafford and there's 60-odd thousand people there and you're in the heat of the battle, what's kind of going through your mind?
Well, I think, like most clubs, it's surviving. Yeah. If you're going to Old Trafford, I mean, that fear factor when Fergie was there was for everyone to see. You know, no one really got anything at Old Trafford. And when I played, no one ever got anything at Anfield. You know, the Souness and Dalgleishes of this world and Rush. So you know, when you go to these big clubs, obviously you've got to make special arrangements, I would call it. You know, you have to make special arrangements for when you play the top four or five clubs in the Premier League. You have to, unless you're one of them. Yeah. And even they make special arrangements when they're playing each other. Mm. We've seen Chelsea and go to Old Trafford without a centre forward, haven't we? Mm. You know, so, but as a newly promoted side with Charlton, and when I first went into West Ham, struggling a little bit, there was a fear factor there, but you've got to try and overcome that, because if the players sense that, especially during the week when you're building up to the game, that perhaps it's all a little bit too negative, it can have an adverse effect.
And how present are you in that moment? I mean, is it, when you look back on it now, when you've managed away at these big teams, can you remember the moments? Can you remember how you reacted to certain things, or are you just very much sort of in the moment and it's a blur now looking back on it?
No, I can remember most things. You know, yeah. if you nudge me, and you know, I always remember our first season at Charlton, at going to Old Trafford, for instance, and I think we went 1-0. Mark Kinsella scored. Ended up getting beat 4-1, but we went 1-0 up, and it was a fantastic moment for everybody. But I remember sitting in the dugouts there, because, you know, I normally sat upstairs for the first half of a game. I like to watch it.
That's so you could see more?
Yeah. And I didn't want to come in at half-time and perhaps criticise a player because I'm watching it at ground level and I haven't actually seen what had gone on. Mm. You know, when you're upstairs, you can see a lot more, obviously. But at Old Trafford, I decided to sit in the dugouts because they're raised.
Yeah.
And I just remember a ball being swung out to Giggs, and he brought it down on his chest and controlled it on the halfway line. And Stevie Brown, my right back, he won't complain about this. He went and closed him down, and he was about 7 yards off him, which is fair enough, you know, closed him down. But he stayed 7 yards all the way into the box.
Right.
When I did want him to engage him at some stage.
Yeah.
And that was, you know, just like a little bit of fear, you know. I mean, as you say, the players know who they're playing against, so they should do. And yeah. Steve knew that if he got too close, then Giggs was going to be a lot quicker. But as I say, when you're playing them top sides, you do have to make some special arrangements.
Yeah. You mentioned half time there. What's your job? What do you see a top level manager's job at half time being? I mean, Glenn Hoddle famously said half time is a time to create positive energy. Do you think, is it too short a time to be sorting detailed things out? How do you approach it?
No, as I say, you can't give the players too much information. You know, it's just going to go over their heads. And especially before a game. But at half time, you want to get perhaps the points across that you need to get across. And I'd always talk to Mervyn Day, my assistant, outside the dressing room. Let the players go in. I would never really go in there and start straight away. Let them perhaps see the physio, get a drink, you know, maybe even have a little chat between themselves. And then come in and then you've got, you know, I think you've got 3 or 4 minutes to have your say. And it may be just individuals. It might be a department of the team. It's not always negative. You could be losing 1-0. It ain't because you're defending. It's because you haven't done enough going forward, you know. Yeah. But you've got to be honest. And, you know, you can't be seen to be picking on certain people, you know. And you've got to have the picture. And as I said, you know, it's no good me walking in at half-time when I haven't actually seen what had gone on. You know, now the technology is fantastic. The manager can see again and again, you know, before he gets in the dressing room, he can see because of laptops and everything else exactly what's gone on. So perhaps it's not the centre-half's fault. It may be because of midfield players let someone go and et cetera, and the build-up. So, but I think 3 or 4 minutes to be concise, to be clear, and as you say, even in negative times, to be as positive as you can.
And you're obviously a good player as well, but you started off as a manager as quite a young man, 34-ish or so, I think. And of course, you were able to learn on the job and stayed at Charlton for quite a long time. How much easier did you find it as you became older to become a manager? Because clearly at 30, were you 34 at the time?
34. Yeah. Actually, you know, I became a player manager, if you like. And that was a lot easier. It was a lot easier for me because I could still go out there on the training ground with the players, so I still had the respect. It was me and Stevie Gritt, who was both contracted as players at Charlton.
Steve Gritt, a very highly respected coach, of course.
Yeah. So, I mean, Lenny Lawrence left the club, and I was basically first team player coach, and Steve was a reserve team player coach. So, we had the players on board, and, you know, we had the team spirit. So, it wasn't so much of a problem for us. I think we hit the ground running, done fantastically well in a first season at Upton Park. We'd left the Valley, gone to Sellers Park, left Sellers Park, gone to Upton Park. And we should have been there a couple of months, and we was there for a season and a half. But we came seventh that year, so we hit the ground running.
Was it instant, the respect the players have for you? Because, I mean, you were a player, so you were one of them, but then you've been upped, and now you're sitting above them. There was no players at all there who had a problem with that?
No. And I think because, you know, so recently we've been one of them. It's a little bit different. Also, I think as coaches, you take your first training session, and players, they either get you or they don't, or they're having you or they're not. You know that sort of thing.
Yeah.
So we was okay. It's just I think it's a little bit harder as a manager coming in to a club, and then you know you're not going to be able to demonstrate unless you're Hoddle and et cetera. Yeah. But you're not going to be able to demonstrate what you want by showing the players physically. So you've got to show them in the coaching, et cetera. So,
you haven't got like a DVD of your greatest hits as a player that you can play to them.
No, but whenever I've been asked advice, especially young managers, is to go and get as many coaching sessions under your belt, because you've got to walk into one day, you've got to walk into a training ground and you're going to have 20 odd players. And you've got to make sure that session runs smoothly. And by the time you get to the end of it, they've understood what you're looking for, what you're trying to achieve. And if you haven't got that experience under your belt, it's going to be very, very difficult. So all the young managers now out there, I'm looking at, you know, Frank Lampard and Steven Gerrard and, you know, two of my ex-players, Scotty Parker and Lee Bowyer, who have all done that coaching while I was playing.
Yeah.
A lot of them have decided that, you know, that's what they want to do, and managed to to go on the courses and gain that experience. I wasn't that lucky because it suddenly fell in my lap, if you know what I mean. You know, Lenny Lawrence left the club and went to Middlesbrough. And to be brutally honest, the club was in such a financial state that me and Stevie Gritt was under contract as players. So they just went, well, you might as well take it.
Right.
So that's how we got it.
Right, okay. There was no one else to do it, basically.
Well, they couldn't afford anybody else, I don't think. And they couldn't sack us either.
No, did you think you were going to be there for 15 years?
No. But we were grateful for the opportunity because you've got to be in the right place at the right time to a certain extent.
Sure.
And I was. And, you know, obviously it's the best thing that happened to me.
And I asked Gordon Strachan about how much it matters that you're a player to become a manager and how long you've got to dine out on the fact that you're a player. And he said you've got about 20 seconds of your first team talk.
Absolutely. Or 20 seconds of your first training session.
Yeah, because they'll know whether you can do it or not.
Yeah, no matter if you've been a fantastic player, this is a different situation completely now. And, you know, as I said earlier, you've got to have your... I know it's a new word now, philosophy. And there's lots of new words that have come into the game since I left it. But you've got to get across what you want from the players. Yeah.
So you would have had a philosophy, though. It's just an idea of how you wanted to play and how you wanted to run the team, right?
Yeah, and it changes as you go along because obviously...
Different players and stuff.
Obviously, when I was at Charlton starting off, as I said, we went to Upton Park, it was all about survival. And for a lot of years, it was about survival, financially. And in whatever league we was in, it got a lot better as we progressed and become more successful. But then when I went to West Ham, the first 6 months was about survival because we was in the bottom three. Yeah. But after that, I changed and wanted to be more aggressive and more purposeful, if you like. And and my attitude changed. But for that first 6 months, I was in survival mode and... it took the players a long time to perhaps come along with me when I first went into West Ham.
Yeah. What sort of, you obviously managed for a long time and you had a chance to, I suspect, sort of run the whole thing at Charlton for quite a long time. What kind of environment were you passionate about generating at Charlton? Because you were responsible for it all. So what kind of, because I think people on the outside like me looking in maybe think of a football team or a football club of that size being quite a masculine, dominant, alpha male kind of environment. But presumably, as a manager, you understand that personalities are different and you have to deal with different people differently. So what kind of environment were you trying to foster?
I think the first thing, you know, when we were signing players, when I first took over with Steve Gritt and when I took over on my own, you know, we was penny pinching and, you know, I remember sitting down with Alan Pardew. We signed Alan Pardew. Me and Stevie Gritt, on a free transfer from Crystal Palace. And it was one of our first signings. And we was arguing over £10, £15.
Right, okay.
We had a budget and we had to, had to stick to it. The club was going bust. And then we progressed to signing, the Darren Bents of this world and Danny Murphy's and et cetera, et cetera. Before that, Clive Mendonca was a record signing. And, we were signing players and perhaps... going into the negotiations, we wasn't so aggressive with the finances, etc. And you can lose that perspective. But I always felt whenever we went for a player and once we got him in a room, I felt really confident we weren't going to lose him, that the player was going to sign for us. Because I think for a long while at Charlton, they understood, a lot of the players understood where we come from and what we was about and what you had to do to be part of it. It was no good coming into Charlton, even if we broke our transfer record, and you thought that you was better than everybody else, and
you'd look at aspects of a player's personality, and would you ever swerve a player because you didn't think he had the character you wanted?
Absolutely, yeah. And
how would you tell that, though, just by meeting them?
No, by asking around. But then, you know, when you're trying to sign, for instance, some of the foreign players that become available, then that's a little bit more difficult.
Yeah.
You know, how do you find out about, you know, their family life or their characters? But when I was, as I say, the early days at Charlton, if you look at the signings we made, certainly in the Premier League, mainly British, a bit like Sean Dyche is doing at Burnley.
Yeah.
And if I did sign a foreign player that was already in the Premier League, I didn't go and get someone from abroad that
because there's too many variables. You didn't know where they were going to settle.
No, there was there was already acclimatised.
Yeah.
So I signed Klaus Jensen from Bolton, Mark Fish from Bolton, Emil Ryerson from Ipswich. You know, people that had already been in the Premier League or knew who we were.
So it was too much of a gamble for you to grab someone from overseas.
Yeah. At the time, yeah.
Okay. Interesting. Well, and is there an element of a manager who needs to be a kind of psychologist as well? You need to, because you said earlier when you talk about half-time team talks, you wouldn't necessarily make it too personal about a player or whatever. Would you have an understanding that certain players wouldn't respond very well to being criticised, or maybe you'd have to take them to one side and talk to them privately, or but other players would give them a kick up the arse they needed?
Well, yeah, I mean, but you know, you obviously know the players that you've got, and if they can. They can take an air dryer or not, or you've got to put your arm around them. But, you know, sometimes, and you hear this a lot from players, they want to see someone called out.
So you think it's better for the overall group for that to happen?
If he ain't doing it, you know, if he's not doing it, and it's no good mollycoddling them. And, you know, if you've called out a couple of others, but there's certain ways of doing it. And there's, you know, some people you can be really aggressive with, and some people you just have to leave well alone, and perhaps you say in a different tone, but then get one of the coaches to go over there afterwards and say, you know, he's let you off there a little bit. You know what he's on about, didn't you?
And right,
you know, you can say to players, listen, you've got 10 minutes or you're off. You know,
right, okay.
But then you go out there for the second half and someone else is having an absolute nightmare.
Right. So you forgot about that one.
You can't. So you've got to be very careful, but. You know, I've come unstuck a couple of times, you know, criticised the player, and, you know, it wasn't all his fault, etc., and lost him for the second half. So, you know, you got to be careful. I mean, it helped when they changed the old subs and you can have a few more subs.
Okay, yeah, give you a bit more flexibility.
Absolutely.
How did you used to view confrontation then? Did you used to wake up in the morning and think, oh, God, I've got to speak to so-and-so today and I'm not really looking forward to it? Or did you just see it as part of your job?
No, I saw it as part of the job, and truth be known, perhaps you can ask her. A few of the ex-players, I probably got involved a bit too much.
Really? Okay.
Yeah, and, you know...
Just because you're so passionate about it?
Yeah, because, you know, you feel that as a manager, you're responsible for everything, and you aren't, you know? You think you're responsible for the whole thing that goes on a Saturday and the result, and you're not, you know? But you feel that weight on your shoulders, and I think also the expectations... Certainly in the Premier League, once you get there, not to be relegated, and you hear, you know, the terrible stories of, like, getting relegated and ground staff having to be sacked and this and that. And
you're very aware of that,
are you? Yeah, you feel the whole weight of that. You do, yeah. You feel the whole weight of that.
Michael Calvin wrote a book called Living on the Volcano, and we had him in here and he did a ramble meets with us. And he went around all the different... a lot of different managers working in England, and the pressure and the stress they're under, particularly at the lower level. Did you ever seriously worry that you were getting too stressed or that it was too bad for your health?
Yeah, and I'm on the LMA committee.
Yeah.
And we take that very seriously. And we're talking to all the managers, not just the top managers, but we're talking to all the managers in every league to look after themselves a bit better, mentally and physically, diet-wise. And, you know, you often... I just read an article at the weekend, Lee Johnson of Bristol City, you know, where completely, you know, the whole thing's took over a little bit and, you know, he's saying he's put a bit of weight on and he finds it perhaps difficult
to switch off
and have conversations and be normal once you get home. And you can't be normal because the phone's going every 5 minutes and it's either... the physio that something's happened, or an agent wants to talk to you, or the chief executive wants to talk to you, or the chairman wants to talk to you, or et cetera, et cetera. And, or the press have got, you know, they've heard something and they want to, you know, so it's very, very difficult to switch off. And, you know, before mobiles were, you know, that big, you know, you'd have two phones in your house. I think a lot of managers have 3 or 4 phones, one for the family, one for agents, perhaps one for the club.
Yeah.
You know,
just to make sure there's always available.
Just make sure that the one's clear. Ringing and, you know, I'm not going to pick that one up for a little while. But obviously, that's the way it is. But I think the way the game is going, certainly in the Premier League, that a lot of the workloads took off. There's a lot more of as you say, you've got sporting directors doing
that. They have a bigger team now, don't they?
You've got people organising the scouts.
Yeah.
I mean,
Pep Guardiola's team is about 21, 22 people now.
Yeah, I remember me and Stevie Gritt on a Wednesday driving to Middlesbrough to watch Middlesbrough play on a Wednesday night. You know, getting home at 5 a.m. and going into training at 8, 9 o'clock.
Yeah.
Because we're playing Middlesbrough at the weekend.
Yeah.
So you know, and we wanted to make sure that we got everything right. But, you know, I remember going out to Barcelona when Bobby Robson was there and he showed us around the training ground and whatever after training, you know. Mm. And it was 2 o'clock and I said, what's your plans now? He said, well, I'm going home.
Right.
I said, yeah, I know. But then what are you doing tonight? He said, well, I'm doing nothing.
Right.
I said, but, well, you know, don't you go back to the ground and, you know, watch, you know, assess this or talk to the... He said, no, other people do that.
Right.
I'll just coach the team.
And that's different. That's what the difference is about the top level.
Yeah. Well, yeah. And I think that's what's happening now.
Yeah.
In the Premier League. Not in the, perhaps, obviously not in the Championship and League One and League Two, but I think in the Premier League now, at the top level, certainly, them sporting directors or, you know, people looking after, you know, you delegate a lot more now. Mm. Whereas when I was coming through, you know, I was looking at people like Fergie and et cetera, et cetera, that run the whole club.
Mm. It doesn't happen so much now, does it?
Oh no, certainly not. And I don't know if that's for the good.
Yeah,
But certainly that's the way we're going.
There's just so much more responsibility now, right? The marketing wise, the commercial side of the club, and all that kind of stuff. Particularly someone like Man United, it's like a global phenomenon, isn't it?
Yeah, just not even that. I mean, if you're talking about teams that are just outside the top four now, you know, like I don't want to say who's outside it at the moment, but if you look on paper, you know, the Arsenals, the Man Uniteds and et cetera, Everton's, clubs like that, you know, the workload of the manager, is greatly reduced. Not the pressures in terms of getting the results, but certainly...
The responsibilities, yeah.
Yeah, responsibility to the club. You know, I used to go and watch the youth team on a Saturday morning before a first team game.
Right.
Because I wanted to find out what if anything's coming through and et cetera, and perhaps get a feedback. But I'd imagine a lot of managers now don't even go anywhere near their academy.
Yeah. Just, I want to come and talk about a certain player final in a minute. But before I do that, because you just mentioned the youth team players there, you've seen a lot of football. You've watched thousands and thousands of games and looked after and observed thousands of players. Something that always fascinates me, again, as a fan from the outside looking in, when you see a kid, 15, 16 or whatever, what are you seeing that makes you know he can go on and have a career? Because all those kids at that level, if they're in an academy at the top level at 15, 16, they're all going to have ability. What is it you see in them where you think that guy stands out?
Well, obviously, it's technical.
Right.
I mean, we had Jermaine Defoe at Charlton from the age of 12, I think. And you knew.
Hmm.
I mean, he came through, got pinched off us by West Ham, but that's another story. But as I mentioned, two players now, Lee Bowyer.
Mm.
He knew Lee was going to be a player.
See, what, because of his drive, because of his mentality, because of his maturity for his age, that kind of stuff?
Yeah, you know, just little things. He'd be doing finishing session, and he'd shoot, Lee Bowyer would shoot, he'd go wide, he'd run after the ball.
Right.
And he'd run all the way back and try and bunk in the queue to have another go.
Right, okay.
You know, and
yeah.
You know, and I remember Scotty Parker doing something in training and he was still a schoolboy, but he'd come in and we took him in with the first team.
Mm.
You know, we knew he was going to come through. And although he didn't come through as quick as he thought he was going to come through, but we knew he was going to come through. And I remember Adam Pardew saying, cool, he's going to be a player.
Mm.
You know, so you do.
But have you seen them come into the first team and then crumble because the pressure's high and they're not quite the right character?
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, we let Scott, for instance, was up at Lillieshaw with the likes of Michael Owen and one or two others.
Mm.
And when he signed for us, he could see that players from that squad playing in their first team.
Yeah.
And he's forever knocking on the door.
Right.
And I'm saying, listen, firstly, you're not ready. I don't think you're ready physically and mentally.
Mm.
Maybe technically, but I don't think you're ready. Secondly, I've got a bit of a problem on my hands here. Look, we're in the bottom six.
Yeah, yeah.
And I don't want to introduce you to that sort of stuff.
Mm. Why didn't you want to do that? Because you didn't keep it a handle the pressure?
No, I didn't want to put him in and then suddenly have to bring him out.
Yeah, okay.
You know, because of results.
The environment's got to be right.
Yeah.
Okay.
So I let him go off on loan to Norwich and he came back a little bit more stronger, a little bit more aggressive. And he knocked on the door and said, oh, you know, when am I going to get a chance?
Mm.
And at the time, I said to him, well, the way you play, You're very, very attack minded at the time, Scotty was, etc. Mm. I can't put you in with Klaus Jensen because it ain't the right mix.
Yeah.
I need you to be a little bit more defensive minded to accommodate, you know. So he went off into the reserves and played a defensive role.
And turned himself into one.
And then knocked on the door.
Right. Okay. Him again.
But then when he came in, I said to him, you know, when you come in, I expect you to stay in.
Mm.
You know, you come in, not just for five or six games, but you come in and you're physically strong enough and mentally strong enough to stay in. And that's exactly what happened to him.
Do you find that a senior pro in that position would be resentful and make it difficult?
No, I think senior pros know when there's someone coming up around them and behind them.
Yeah.
But
surely you get a negative reaction to that sometimes.
Well, yeah, you may get that, but they know. They know that perhaps this kid's going to come through and take their place. It may not be this season, but it will be at some stage.
Yeah.
And they start looking around.
Right, you know, okay.
You know what I mean. And, you know, I always go back to John Lyle when I was coming through at West Ham.
You played with some good players in your career, right?
Oh, I got put in with Billy Bonds and Trevor Brooking and Graham Paddon. And, you know, I went in for one or two games, came out, et cetera, then gone back in. But in all fairness, he was given a chance then.
Right.
A bit more of a chance. And, you know, it's a little bit more difficult now. But, you know, as my time ended at West Ham with John Lyle, you know, and I've said this many times, you know, if John had said to me 2 and 2 was 4, I'd have said it was 5.
Right, okay.
If he said to me that was black, I would be saying no, that's white.
Right.
You know, that's the way it was. I was 19, 20.
Thought you knew everything, yeah.
Should have been playing, weren't playing, and you know, and I often use that with the young players coming through. Look, I've been there. I've been where you've been.
Yeah.
And let me tell you know, I moved on and perhaps I shouldn't have.
Yeah, okay.
You know, and just be a little bit more patient. But that's very difficult now, you know, for a young player to accept that.
Final question on this kind of young player angle. Do you think it's possible, in your experience, for a really shy, introverted boy to become a top-level footballer?
Yeah.
You do?
Yeah. Because once they get out on that pitch...
That's what matters.
It's a different... They may be perhaps shy and introvert off the pitch.
Mm.
And I think you see a lot of young players now. Not just young players, but, we're talking young players. You know, you would see them perhaps walking into a game with headphones on, head down.
Mm.
You know, don't really want to engage.
Mm.
And perhaps they're like that off the pitch, after training, etc., and it can be a lonely place for them.
But can that be hard when it comes to team building, trying to get people to knit together as a unit?
Yeah, but I think once they're let loose and, you know, in training or doing the thing they really want to do, then their true selves come out. And I think you're finding a lot of players off the field, you know, don't trust anybody, don't engage.
Because of the lifestyle they have to live. Yeah,
yeah. Or perhaps they get tripped up. You know, there's lots of them getting tripped up. So, you know, some of them do lead a lonely life, except when they're doing the thing they really like.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. How's your social battery right now? We're nearly at the end of the Premier League season, so I'm pretty drained. So many tense matches, and some not so tense, as well as point deductions, a battle for the title, and teams on the brink of relegation. All that suspense has me needing a well-deserved break. With the year in full swing, it can be easy to get swept up in work, social engagements, even keeping up with all this football, and we can spread ourselves too thin. But with therapy, you can learn to prioritise your time and really recharge your batteries. It's helpful for learning how to set personal boundaries and empowering you to be the best version of yourself, because you should spend your time on your own terms. So, if you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist and switch therapists at any time for no additional charge. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/ramble today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/ramble.
I mentioned earlier we're going to talk about the 98 playoff final, which is presumably a highlight of your career. People listening will know that a few weeks ago we had Mickey Gray in here.
Oh, hi.
And he obviously gave his side of the story about the 4-4 draw, then the penalties. It's really interesting to me because clearly that is an event that affected him quite badly for quite a long time. You know, local boy missing that decisive penalty. In that moment, presumably you're full of joy and looking forward to what's coming next. Do you, when you look back on it now, do you feel for Mickey?
No, not at all. Not at all. Because, you know, that's the game. It put us back on the map, Charlton.
I should say you do know him, so you...
Yeah, absolutely.
So you're able to say that.
No, it put us back on the map. Hmm. It put me on the map.
Yeah. Was it the most important thing in your career, do you think?
Yeah, because I'll tell you for why. I had four or five players that if we hadn't gone up, I think would have been took off me.
Right.
And the team would have been disintegrated and it would have been another rebuilding job. And on the day, I mean, I've known Peter Reid since we were 17 in the England youth team together, under 21s, etc. And they were big enough and strong enough to come back from that, which they did the next season.
Sure.
We wouldn't have come back from that, I don't think.
Right.
If we'd have got beat.
So it's a big sliding doors moment for Charlton then.
Yeah, I had people after Rufus, Kinsella, Madonka, you know, you name it. They're looking at them and Sean Newton, etc. And the players, Danny Mills was me right back and, you know.
How'd you feel in the game? Because, I mean, you didn't plan for a 4-4 and it was crazy. So did you feel completely powerless? It's just one of those days you're just going to have to be in the lap of the gods.
Talking about half-time team talks, I always remember it, that at half-time we were winning 1-0 and Sunderland were very offensive side. You know, Noel Quinn and Phillips up top and Nicky Summerby and this one and that one. And I said to the players, look, I think we've got Sunderland exactly where we want them. You know, if we can keep it tight for 10 minutes, they'll open up or they'll make a change and go for it. And we was a good counter-attacking side and I think we could take full advantage. But we've got to keep them quiet for 10 minutes. And I've been in the dugout for 5 minutes into the second half and we were 2-1 down. You know, right. The whole thing had changed completely.
So that was a waste of time.
And
Were you upset about the goals? Were you fuming about the defending? Is there, even in with all your experience, is there just part of you that says, this is football and you can't control anything?
Yeah, you can always pick things out defensively when you've let a goal in. And we did defend poorly for the two, I must admit, when I see him again. But that's the way it was. And the atmosphere had changed completely. You know, I then made a couple of changes. I always remember bringing Mark Bright off and him moaning his head off. Still moaning as he's sitting next to me.
Yeah.
And I put Steve Jones on, who was going to run around a bit more and whatever. And, you know, I had Bright's experience in the first 60-odd minutes and he was a bit grizzly. But then we got back in the game 2-0, you know. And it's what happens. And, you know, I made another change. John Robinson, who had been injured, had been a major player for me. Yeah. John Robinson had been injured into the lead up to the final. I managed to get him on. And, you know, he made a bit of a difference. And, you know, Stevie Brown came on and tightened us up defensively. So, you know, you make changes and they all worked. On the day, you know, you couldn't wish much more that you had probably the best final ever.
Oh, I loved watching it as a neutral.
When I see the goals going in, you know. And then the penalties.
How did you plan for penalties?
Well, it's really interesting because we did have our five. Because
you had thought about that in advance?
Yeah, and we practiced penalties. We practiced walking from the centre circle. You know, it's not the same, but you know, we've done it. But what a lot of people won't realise is that Eddie Wolstenholme was the ref and me and Reedy went into the centre circle and we had to nominate our first five penalty takers. And then we were out of it.
Mm.
We actually went back to the dugouts and sat down.
Right.
But he went to five all.
Yeah.
So then the players had to start picking who was going to be the next penalty taker.
Mm.
And I think they got to seven all or whatever, or six all or whatever. And Eddie Walsenone turned around to, I think Richard Rufus was in the Richard Rufus, Eddie Yowds, Stevie Jones and Sean Newton. He turned around and went, come on.
Yeah,
one of you's got to take a penalty.
Yeah, yeah.
And I only got told a couple months later that Richard Rufus pushed Sean Newton out of the centre circle.
Did he?
Yeah. And if you see it again, Sean jogs all the way to the penalty spot, because I don't think he'd have made it if he'd have walked.
No, okay, right, yeah, yeah.
And I didn't know, obviously, I didn't know. And, you know, he took his penalty and scored, and then I think Mickey's come up and missed these.
Mickey said that Danny Dicchio, who was a striker, had taken his boots off.
Yeah,
and refused to take one.
Yeah, yeah.
They're friends now. I think there's no harm done or whatever, but I think at the time he was quite put out by that.
Yeah, and as I say, people want to take penalties and people don't.
Would you blame a player for not wanting to?
Yeah.
No.
If he doesn't want it, I'd rather him say it to me.
But do you not think they should have more character about them than that? Or is that easy for me to judge from the outside?
No. I think if they're not comfortable, I'd rather have someone going up there who's saying, look, I want to take that.
Even if they're not technically anywhere near as good?
Well, as I say, I've never seen Sean Newton take a penalty before.
Okay. I suppose all top pros should better strike a ball into the back of net for 12.
Yeah, but under that pressure.
Yeah.
And in a final. And the way the game was going, and once you get to sudden death as well, you know, once you got past 5-5, it was an amazing day, and as I say, it was a massive turning point for us because we got ourselves back to the Valley, and we'd lost a generation of fans.
Yeah,
you know, the 7-year-olds were now 17-year-olds supporting other teams.
Yeah,
you know, and we needed to get them back so that they become Charlton fans. And that was the start. I mean, we got relegated the next season.
How big was the gap in terms of quality? How hard did you find it, you and your team, to try and manage in the Premier League?
I didn't find it that difficult. We went down in the last game of the season.
But the mentality must have to totally change.
Yeah. I'll tell you, for just one simple fact. When you're a newly promoted side, when you win promotion, you win 26 games.
Yeah.
You probably draw 10 and lose 10 or whatever, you know, but you win... You win 26, 27 games. You look at the history.
Yeah.
But to be successful in your first season in the Premier League, you've got to win 10.
Yeah.
So you're thinking you've got to win a third of what you won.
So your teams almost have to get used to losing and not letting it affect them.
Oh, you're going to go on a run. When in fixtures come out, you know that you could go for three or four games without picking anything up.
Yeah.
But when you play against teams that are in and around you, you know you must pick something up. And that's when people talk about that sort of scenario. And the other major difference, and I've been asked this many times, what is the big difference between the Championship and a Premier League? Well, let me tell you, your team coming up from the Championship, your quickest player is probably going to be one of the slowest in the opposition's team.
Yeah.
Established Premier League sides.
Yeah, I've heard players say the same.
It's the pace.
This is fast.
It's
yeah.
the pace. Over 10 yards.
Yeah.
You know, it's the pace. And, you know, you can't bridge that gap in one season or even in two. You know, you have to slowly do that. So, you know, we done it by the tactics we used, the teamwork, the organisation, etc. When we're in certain positions, we worked ever so hard. If you ask my ex-players, we probably worked too hard.
Right, okay.
You know, it's one of the negatives.
Were they tired, you think?
Not tired, but it's repetitive and all right, we've done it, but you have to keep drumming it home, you know, you have to keep drumming it home. And as I say, after becoming established after 3 or 4 years, then perhaps your philosophy changes a bit.
Yeah, okay. Moving on to the West Ham thing, I mean, they looked destined for relegation when you went in there, but you kept them up and you were there for a couple of years, or nearly 2 years, I think. And the reason you resigned is, I hope I'm not speaking out of turn here, but the reason you resigned is because you were unhappy with the club's transfer policy. Is that fair? Things that went on.
Yeah.
And that was in 2008. Did you ever plan at that point to be out of the game for so long?
No.
Because you had a lot to offer. You've managed, I mean, I think you're in the top 10 of Premier League managers in terms of games managed. You managed, I think, almost 800 games or something like that. It seems bizarre. I don't know you very well, so it might be I just don't know why, but it seems bizarre that you'd be out of the game for such a long time at that point, because you'd left a Premier League team.
Yeah, and it was a difficult time because, you know, I resigned. Managers never resigned. They got sacked.
Why did you feel like you had to resign?
Because I wasn't running the club. I wasn't in charge anymore in terms of player recruitment.
Mm.
And I always felt that if you're responsible for results, then you've got to be in charge of that side of it. Unless you go into a club when it's made clear, which we spoke earlier about sporting directors.
Yeah,
that you're not in charge of recruitment and you're just going to coach the team, then fine. You know, that's what you've signed up to.
But you hadn't signed up to that.
I hadn't signed up to that. And it was deadline day and we only played 3 or 4 games, but we were 5th in the league at West Ham at the time.
Mm.
And I thought I had a good side, but I had quite a few injuries. And they wanted to sell another player. And it just, anyway, it resulted in me leaving. And by the time it was sorted out, it took a year.
And you couldn't work anywhere else?
Well, yeah, if something came up. But obviously people weren't going to be interested in you if you had something hanging over you like that,
sure.
I think. And it took a year to sort out, which should never have happened. And Richard Scudamore at the Premier League, I'm glad to see, has sorted it out now. It was a difficult time. I resigned. And not soon after that, Kevin Keegan resigned at Newcastle.
Newcastle, yeah.
And I think a little bit later, Martin O'Neill resigned. So suddenly, you had managers resigning. Well, it never happened before. You know, they'd been sacked. So it took a year to sort out.
Do you think other managers wouldn't have resigned on principle like that?
They'd just stayed there.
Yeah.
They would have stayed there. But you know what? West Ham, I was born in Forest Gate, brought up in Canning Town, West Ham boy. It was my ambition to manage them. And that's why it was difficult to do what I did. But I felt a responsibility that if I was responsible for results, then I had to be, you know, if I failed, it was because I failed.
You had to have the room to be able to do your job properly.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
And, you know, so it was a big decision I made and it took a year to sort out. But then after that, and it's my fault entirely why I'm not back in football.
Okay.
Because I was offered situations, offered jobs, championship jobs, clubs in the Premier League that were really struggling with dozen games left, etc.
Yeah.
I felt with my record and what I'd done, there was a club out there that I could go in and give it another go and start a season, you know. And,
yeah.
But I remember Alex saying to me, Alex Ferguson saying to me, don't be out too long. And then suddenly I was out for 2 years. Then it was a little bit longer. And then I'm not getting offered anything in terms of where I thought I was going to be at. And, his advice was right. And you often see managers jump back in, jump straight back in. And that's to get back in because once you're out,
I don't want to be out of touch. Yeah.
You're quickly forgotten.
Yeah. Okay.
And football changes and owners change. Chief executives change, and agents are involved, and they've got their own clients and etc. So, you know, when you think, especially in the Premier League now, everyone in the world wants to work there.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, so it's a world market now, isn't it? Yeah.
So it's difficult to get in there in the first place, and you know, I see the British managers there. Mainly, they've got to win promotion and stay there.
Yeah.
Bit like Sean Dyche, bit like Chris Hughton did at Brighton, etc. So it's much more difficult and it became more difficult. So I've then suddenly drifted away from it. And for the first time for a long while, I had time on my hands and I had a different lifestyle.
Yeah.
And I was doing TV and et cetera, which is obviously not the same, but it keeps you involved. But now I'm out too long.
Yeah.
So
do you honestly think that's that now?
I don't think I'll get offered anything. I don't think...
you wouldn't have any interest in going somewhere lower down or anything like that?
No, not low down. But if I was asked... I was asked to go into Fulham with Rennie Mullerstein.
Yeah.
But that only lasted a month, just to be an advisor, as a mentor.
Yeah.
And then Kit Simons, which lasted a bit longer. But I was happy to do that sort of role. I don't think it'd be a problem if I went back in. I mean, only as if you've been on Mars.
No, and, it's the same sport.
You've lost complete contact. But no, I've been out too long now, and I look from afar. And, you know, as I said, I'm on the League Managers Committee, so if there's any young managers out there that think they need just another voice or another pair of eyes, I'd be happy to help them, because I know how difficult it is now, especially in your first job. To you know, to be successful. And, you know, when I took over my own at Charlton, I phoned four or five of the big boys, big managers, and asked their advice, what they thought. And one of them said to me, you got to win games.
Yeah.
Sounds
obvious.
Just
yeah.
win more games than you lose and you'll
yeah.
be all right.
Yeah.
And perhaps that's what you got to do.
Around that time, I mean, between the Charlton and West Ham time, or perhaps a bit before, you were linked to some very high-profile jobs. I mean, you were linked to the Liverpool job, and I believe you were interviewed for the England job. Is that correct?
Yeah.
And, Bobby, and you got a ringing endorsement from Sir Bobby Robson, who said that you were the best equipped candidate to deal with it at the time.
Wow. Right. Well,
how did that go?
Well, it didn't go particularly well, I don't think, because I think myself, Sam Allardyce.
This was in, what, 2006?
Yeah, Steve McLaren and maybe a couple of others, I'm not sure. But I got interviewed by Brian Barwick, but I was actually caught being right. interviewed. I met him at my brother's house
right.
just to have like tea and biscuits, just to say hello before.
Is this before you left Charlton?
No, I was still at Charlton.
You're there,
okay. Charlton, and the chairman knew,
okay.
obviously, but not too many other people. So the first meeting was just to have a chat, just to say hello. And then the second one was going to be like more in depth, where you pitch for the job, etc.
Right.
And so the first meeting, went okay. And we had a chat. And I remember, and this is how it is, you know, I was on the Saturday, I went with a chief European scout, drove to Lille.
Right.
To watch a French game
mm-hmm.
on a Saturday evening. And the next day at 1:30, we're playing Middlesbrough
mm-hmm.
at home, a live Sky game. So I was out Saturday night
right.
to all hours in the morning.
Yeah.
And then and then had a game on the Sunday. But as we're coming home through the tunnel, I got a phone call saying there's an article in one of the papers that you've been caught talking to Brian Barwick.
Right.
And it's all going to blow up the next morning, which it did. And,
right.
you know, we had a live game. So someone had took a picture and et cetera, et cetera. So it all got out, basically, and all the other boys that had been interviewed hadn't got out.
Right, so you think that impacted on you?
May have, but then we had an FA Cup replay, which was the week that the FA was having the first round of interviews.
Right.
So I couldn't go on it.
Right, okay.
So
that seems crazy.
Yeah, I just couldn't go
because,
you know, we had a game and the chairman didn't want me to go and et cetera, which is fine. So I had a more of an informal. I think the boys went and give a presentation. The more I hear about it, you know, an in-depth thing. And I got the feeling when I had the second meeting, their minds were made up, basically. And I gave the job to Steve McLaren, who had been working with Sven.
Yeah.
So I understood that as well. But that sort of episode, that was near the end of the season. And that put a little thing in. Myself and Charlton at the time, I had a year left of my contract. It had got out about England and everything else. And Richard Murray at the time, the chairman, wanted me to sign a new 3-year deal.
Mm.
I'd been there, as you said before, 15 years.
Yeah.
And, you know, I didn't want to sign a longer contract. I was happy to do the final year. And I could understand the club's position that if I was trying to sign players that summer and putting them on 3 or 4 year contracts,
mm.
then I might not be around that long.
Yeah.
Which I don't think bothers players now, but it might have done then.
Yeah.
You know, so I understood the club side of the argument, and the more we discussed it, it became the situation, that's why I left.
Yeah. At that point, do you think you'd have done a good job as an England manager? And how badly did you want the job?
I didn't think I was ready for it.
Right. But you felt like you couldn't turn it down?
No.
Like Steve McLaren.
Yeah,
basically.
I didn't think I was ready for it. Yeah. I think that you have to... No, I don't think be a certain age. I don't think that. But you have to have a lot more experience.
Right.
And the big difference is, for me, is that you're not exactly... You know, you're not buying players and selling players and bringing them in and whatever.
You don't get to spend as much time in the market.
No.
Yeah.
But the players that you pick to come into that squad, you expect them to turn up full of enthusiasm.
Yeah.
Because, you know, you walk into your club on a Monday morning, you've got four or five of them a bit fed up because they've been left out and
okay.
want to transfer and, you know, down tools in training and whatever. But you don't expect that from an England squad. So I think it was a different mentality what you had. But I also felt it was more experienced manager. I mean, I think they went with Steve, and I endorsed that completely because he'd been involved. I mean, he'd been involved at Man United with Alex and et cetera, with all the big players, and a lot of them was going to be in the squad. So I understood that. But I don't think, no, I don't think I was ready for that.
But you would have taken it?
Oh, yeah.
If
it had been offered, yeah.
What do you think about the way Steve McClaren was treated?
Par for the course, I think.
Because, I mean, it can be a bit, obviously it was very unfair, and I imagine I was part of the media sort of taking the rise out of him or whatever. But as a manager yourself, you presumably you feel that
you're seeing it
quite
way,
keenly.
You're seeing it away through Graham Taylor.
Yeah.
We had a lot of time for Graham, et cetera, even Bobby Robson. And, you know, in the end, if you're not, what did that manager say to me? You've got to win games.
Yeah.
And if you're not winning games, then you know it's coming your way, not just if you're the England coach, but club coach as well.
Yeah.
You know? When you start reading about a club manager where an insider says,
yeah,
that's when that manager's in a little bit of trouble,
right? Yeah,
and you know it's par for the course, and as managers you accept it.
You just accept it.
You got to get
on
with it.
You don't like it, but you accept it.
You got to get on with it. It's part and parcel of the game.
Any regrets? Anything you'd done differently in your career? Anything you think you could have done better with?
No, I've been quite lucky that every decision I've made as a player and as a manager, it's been my decision.
Yeah. And that's all you can ask for, really.
Yeah. And not really been influenced too much. But if I've got a regret, yeah, leaving West Ham.
Yeah, okay.
Both as a player, a little bit, because, as I said, I was a little bit headstrong.
Yeah.
You know, 19, 20, played nearly 100 games and thought I should have been a regular at the time. And perhaps if I'd have stayed, I would have been.
Mm.
You know, Alvin Martin was, and Jeff Pike, we all grew up, Paul Brush, we all grew up together. And they managed to get in the side and stay there, and leaving the club as a manager, because I thought that, you know, we stayed up that year, my first 6 months. The second season we come 10th, and then the next season, as I say, we was in the top five, but I had a decent side.
Mm.
You know, I left a decent side. Okay, Gianfranco Zola went in and he finished 9th in the end, but that was my team.
Yeah,
that it took me 2 years. To get a few of my players in there, get my attitude across, etc. And that's the big regret.
But your principles at the time were very important to you, and you felt like it was the only thing you could do.
I'll go back to the one thing that all managers must you know, it's got to be the written rule that you know, if you go into a football club in charge of recruitment, then you're in charge of recruitment, and you live and die by your signings and what happens on the pitch.
Hmm.
If you go into a club as a head coach and someone else is bringing them signings in, and you go in there under that situation, then you've got no complaints. And I often see managers complaining, certainly at the big clubs, you know, well, you know, I'm not in control of signings. Well, that's what you signed up for.
Yeah.
So I don't understand what you're saying.
Yeah.
But it wasn't what I signed up for. And, you know, if a job would have come along couple of years afterwards, and it was made clear to me that you're not involved in that side of it, you're just the coach, which I know happens at a few clubs, or quite a few clubs, then I would have accepted that. Mm. But I think because it was, you know, my boyhood club and, you know, brought up in the area, it meant a bit more to me that if I'm in charge of this club, then I've got to be totally in control.
So
not everything.
You felt like you couldn't make any other decision in that situation?
No. And, you know, it was disappointing because, as I say, I could have gone to, could have gone there on a previous occasion and had stayed at Charlton, because I didn't think I was ready.
Yeah.
And, you know, then the opportunity came along and I felt I was ready, but, you know, it's history now. Mm. So, yeah, I mean, I've got over the disappointment of it all, but when I think back at it, and I see what's happening with the club now, and I see what's happening with my old club, Charlton.
Mm.
You know, swing highs and lows, swings around.
Yeah. And finally, Alan, because you've been very generous with your time, but just quickly before you go, I mean, you've seen a lot of players, you've managed a lot of players, you've managed teams against a lot of great players. Who's the finest, best player you think you've seen in all your years?
There's so many in terms, you know, I've spoke about the great Liverpool side.
Yeah.
70s and 80s, you know, and I'm not being disrespectful here, but the spine of Clements, Hansen, Souness, Dalglish and Rush.
Yeah.
You know, playing against that.
Yeah.
And then you know, some of the players I play against, like the World Cup players, like Alan Ball, people like that, yeah. Different class. Managing and against that great Man United team, the treble team.
Yeah.
You know, when you think about the players, Ronaldo at the time, Giggs and Beckham, yeah. And them, yeah. Sort of players. But I think the player for me that probably has graced the Premier League since I've been involved in it as a manager is Omri.
Yeah.
I think because...
You just couldn't deal with him?
No. I don't think many people could.
Mm. You couldn't make a plan for him at all?
No, and he had the ammunition. You know, he had Vieira and Petit behind him. He had, yeah. Lundberg and Perez either, yeah. side. He had Bergkamp around him.
He had a lot to worry about.
But he frightened the life out of you.
Yeah.
And a lot of players did, but I just think Thierry Henry, whenever he picked the ball up, when I was managing, you know, you thought, something's going to happen here,
yeah.
especially in the final third. But I think we've been, you know, graced by so many great players, and we will be.
Mm.
I just hope that the Premier League, there's a responsibility to bring players through, some of these young players, and I just hope they get a chance. But, you know, if you're a top six manager, the expectation levels is you've got to be in that top six or better. So that has an influence on team, sure. selection. And if you're a bottom six manager, where'd you go? Do you put a youngster in or do you stick with experience?
It's tough,
because
isn't it? Tough
because
decision,
of the,
yeah.
responsibilities of staying in the league. You know, so I just hope that there's managers out there. The one manager I look at, and I've got a lot of time for, is Pochettino. Because at the moment, he puts kids in if they're good enough, you know, and he's not afraid to do it.
Very, very, very finally, this is absolutely my last question. What do you think, in your experience, makes a very top world-class player?
Well, I think the first thing is pace. I don't think any player now, if you've not got the pace, you're not going to be a top player.
Is it a mentality that you've witnessed though as well? Like,
yeah, because you just can't, it's the game is so quick now, and the Premier League is counter-attacking league. I just look at that Man City side, and I've said this on a few occasions. If Man City turned up for a Premier League game on a Saturday, and a referee said, "Look, we're not going to have a football match. What we're going to do? We're going to have a race."
Yeah.
The goalkeeper's going to race the goalkeeper. The right back's going to race the right back. I think Man City might win most of them races.
Yeah, and that's a big part of it.
That's the big part of it. And the opposition at the moment against Man City and Liverpool have a job on their hands because of their pace. And that is the biggest difference. And that is what every top player has to have.
Alan, thank you very much for your time. It's been great.
Okay, thank you.
This was a Stakhanov production.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Kate Thornton. Join me every week on White Wine Question Time, the podcast that asks famous faces three thought-provoking questions over three glasses of wine.
It's very rare to be introduced with such a thorough introduction, and it's kind of lovely to listen to all that and go, yeah, I've had a good life, right?
You really have.
How did you find that?
I can't even remember.
Yeah.
You do your research, Kate, man. I'll tell you that.
Do you know what? You are the only person ever, no other journalist has ever made that connection.
Wow, what a great question.
And receives some truly memorable answers.
And Tom Cruise came, and Nicole Kidman. I go to him, listen, before you go, Tom, I just want you to know, if you fancy a foursome, I'm up for it, and I know Anne-Marie doesn't mind.
When I first dated my now husband, I joined a gym for, I'm going to say, £1,000 a year, just so I could go off and have a poo.
Actually, I got heckled once in Wales, and there was a bloke at the bar on crutches, and he actually said to me, I'd rather fall over than listen to this shit, and he threw his crutches at me and fell over. Can you believe that?
I've got some cat's ashes, I don't know who they are.
You've been catfished by your own cat.
Exactly, seriously, man.
Dad, have you thought about putting in a breakfast nook? And my dad would say something like, have you thought about getting your own fucking house?
How did you give a duck an orgasm, Craig?
It's good with them, you know.
And then we'll weigh around a duck.
So if you fancy a sit down with the likes of Adam Hills, Tom Allen, Hannah Waddingham, Phil Tufnell, James Acaster and Ed Gamble, Daisy May Cooper and tons more, then join me every Tuesday and Friday. Search White Wine Question Time in your podcast app to subscribe and listen now. White Wine Question Time is a Stack production.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hey, folks, it's Mark Maron from WTF. I've been talking to all kinds of famous people in my garage since 2009, including a sitting president.
You know, I don't imagine you were flying in here on the chopper thinking like, you know, I am nervous about Mark.
No, I wasn't.
Okay, well, that's good.
That would be a problem.
It would be a problem.
If the president was feeling stressed about
coming to my garage.
Coming to your garage.
And now there's even more WTF when you subscribe to the full Marin to get weekly bonus content and all WTF episodes ad-free. Listen to WTF wherever you get podcasts and subscribe to the full Marin at go.acast.com/WTF.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.